Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Talk with Tenny. I hope all is going well for you out there. It's been another interesting day with plenty going on. I want to give the line out to you if you'd like to call in. The area code is 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need the toll-free line, which is limited for people who want to call in and maybe ask a question and or two, that is area code 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351 is the toll-free number. So today there have been all kinds of events going on in the world with people responding to the real problems that our culture is experiencing and our social society is really at a huge loss here. And so I think it's very important that we keep our eye on the prize and continue to talk about human rights and why our human rights need to be protected and promoted. I do want to inform people about a couple of conferences that are coming up. The Mind Freedom Creative Revolution Conference will be on from July 24th to July 27th in Connecticut. The keynote speakers will include Bob Whitaker and Mary Ellen Copeland, and you can get information there about the conference at mindfreedom.org. And then from July 13th at 6 p.m. to July 16th at 6 p.m., we will be holding vigil on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health at the 34th Annual Alliance's Bastille Day vigil, and that will be July 13th to the 16th. And then June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m., we will be holding a vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered by neglect at Kings County Hospital Psychiatric Emergency Room. And it's very important that we continue to speak out and organize in order to be able to have our voices heard and our rights preserved. And for people who are currently struggling with psychiatry, it's very important for you to know that you are not alone and that there are people out there who have been through it and who can offer support, and that you also can get out of these experiences, and this isn't for the rest of your life. This doesn't have to be the way it is for the rest of your life. The number to call in is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. Yes, hello, your line is open.
Hi, how are you? It's
Lauren,
it's Sue.
Hi, Sue, how are you?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think there's one word I think that people are using that's wrong. It's not psychiatric murder, it's psychiatric genocide. I think we have to bring this forward. I think we have to go to the UN. It is not just murdering of psychiatric patients by electroshock and psychiatric drugs. This is genocide. There are millions of people damaged, you know, by electroshock. People have died from the drugs. So now I'm going to post in my post and in my book, genocide.
Well, I think it's a good point, and it's an important point. I think that there also are murders that occur, psychiatric murders that occur, and that it is like in the case of Esmond Green, that where it was a murder by neglect. But certainly the drugs on a large scale, if you were to really look at what it is that they're doing with the known 15 to 30 year loss of life for the psychiatric drugs, for let's say, I think it's an important point to definitely do, and I think that there's that it's important for people to understand that there's, in the past, certainly has been plenty of evidence for how it is we have been marched into the gas chambers, and that the gas chambers were tested on people with disabilities, and that the way people view who quote-unquote mental patients are is not positive. People with psychiatric histories are not looked at in the society positively, and that's part of the problem, and that's why they can do to us whatever it is that they choose without having anybody really held accountable for how it is that they're acting. So I thank you for calling in to bring in that perspective, because I do think it's important that people think about things in larger terms.
Yeah, like I was thinking about that today when I saw some of the documentaries on the YouTube about, you know, the Bedlam, places like, okay, the Broadmoor in the UK, stuff like that. And then I thought, a lot of people have been murdered by this. Like in, you know, the Nazis that killed us. You know, people that were, the mentally challenged, gay people with the disabilities. And so what happened was, I was just thinking about this today. I really never thought of the word genocide before, and it just hit me like, whoa, that's really what's happening to us, you know?
Right, and I think, you know, and I think that, you know, people think if you look at what genocide is, when you're talking about a systemic destruction of all or part of a particular group of people, and I think that, you know, including it's killing them, but it also includes causing serious body or mental harm or grave bodily injury to people, inflicting on them, you know, terrible conditions in which they must live under, creating ways in which they can which can prevent their births. The birth of further people. So I think that this is, you know, I'm just looking on Wikipedia here, you know, for the take it with a grain of salt. But what does it say? Forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. I mean, this is how if you're a parent with a psychiatric history, how your child can be taken away from you, like in New York State, public health law states, For no reason, simply for having a psychiatric history, and the way that the drugs limit the libido and have all kinds of sexual side effects in terms of preventing people from being able to have sex. I mean, you can start to argue how, by characteristic, whereas first what you're talking about seems like a little bit of a harsh, you know, extreme kind of position, genocide, psychiatry is genocide. You know, I mean, obviously others have talked about this, but, you know, there are definite reasons why you can see how this can happen, especially when you start to think, is it deliberate? That's probably where the line always gets drawn with people, where people start to say, well, the psychiatrists aren't deliberately hurting people. The psychiatrists aren't deliberately killing people. But even when the psychiatrists know that there's a 15 to 30 year loss of life for the drugs that they're giving people, they don't necessarily stop. So what is deliberate, I think, becomes another whole question. But the way that they're able to hide all of their actions behind this, you know, gaze of do-gooding for your own good kind of mentality, I think, mm-hmm. is a big part of the problem. But I think that, you know, that we need to keep talking about it and exposing these things. And I think that, you know, I get a lot of slack for using language like this, and, you know, language like such as slavery. People say that it just turns off anybody in power. But even E. Fuller Torrey and Robert Yochin in 2010 wrote an article in Schizophrenia Bulletin called Psychiatric Genocide, Nazi Attempts to Eradicate Schizophrenia. And we've talked about this article before, but, you know, where he very clearly, they very clearly, sorry, go through how it was that people with schizophrenia were used and tested tested in creating the gas chambers. They write, killing of psychiatric patients. The planning and logistics for such mass murders elicited much discussion. The method finally chosen was the release of carbon monoxide gas into a closed room outfitted to look like a shower room, and the subsequent burning of the bodies in the crematoria. Gold fillings were removed from the deceased and used partially to pay for the program. This is the Action T4 program. In early January 1940, the first 20 patients were led into a, quote, shower room at the Brandenburg Asylum and killed. This method was judged to be highly successful and was later adapted for the killing of Jews. Five additional asylums at Bernberg, Granefeck, Hadamar, Harsheim, and Sonnestein were designed as killing centers, and patients marked for death at other hospitals were transported to these regional centers. By August 1941, 70,273 patients had been killed. Careful records were kept, and the six centers competed with each other in efficiency. Hadamar, e.g., quote, celebrated the cremation of its 10,000th patient in a special ceremony where everyone in attendance, secretaries, nurses, and psychiatrists, received a bottle of beer for the occasion. Once the initial goal of killing the 70,000 patients was achieved, the Action T4 program was halted. Although some resistance to the program had developed, especially among the churches and its communities near the killing center, the T4 program personnel were needed for a bigger job. And there you have it. And so they made rooms that looked like shower stalls and marched people in and gassed them to death to eradicate. And this is Torrey. This is E. Fuller Torrey and Yochin, the presenters of the theory that schizophrenia is caused by toxoplasma gondii, cat feces, by handling cat feces, and who are the leading supporters of the idea of forced psychiatric treatment. And you would think that with this kind of history, of knowledge of history, that they wouldn't be pushing forth the new march of us into the shower stalls, but they are leading the calls. They are leading the calls.
You know what I think, Lauren?
Yes.
I mean, if you take away, okay, the doctor title, okay, if you had thousands of people all across the world that weren't doctors, just Joe and Jane and, you know, Jorgen and, you know, the Margarita, like all with people that didn't have a doctor title, if they were doing this, you know, the shocking, the drugging of people, that would be called genocide. But because it has a doctor's title, a name, Dr. So-and-so, that's why they're not being charged as criminals. They have the doctor title to hide behind. It's treatment. We're trying to help people. But that is a ruse. That's a lie.
Yeah.
They're not helping people. So, I mean, if I did this, okay, if we had a group of, let's say, not us, but say in the world there were, like 100,000 people in different countries, like in Canada, U.S., like a whole bunch of, like, a, okay, like a bunch of people that were organized, didn't have a doctor's title, and did this, you know, to the neighbors, you know, and to grandma and to their daughters, shocked them and drugged them up. That would be called genocide as a huge group of people all across the world. But in my estimation, because they have a doctor's title, they hide behind the doctor's title to do this. That there is it right, I'm hitting that right on the nose, the doctor's title. They're allowed to do that and get away with it.
I think it does give them the rights and privileges to be able to do as they wish with the huge backing of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, let's not forget that a doctor can't do this just because a doctor wants to do this. There is a product mm-hmm. there that is being made, that is being promoted, that is being that is being pushed, and that is being bought.
Yes.
And so I must be in a particularly nice and good feeling kind of mood today, because usually I'm the first to, you know, put it right down on the doctor. But there is this whole other industry that is fueling the doctor's motivations. And like we were talking yesterday, even in the textbooks, they push this garbage from the earliest stages of learning, so that there is no disputing it by the time they get to a point of, and the indoctrination is, you know, cinched. And I think that that's part of the issue. Sue, please stay on the line. But if you'd like to call in, area code 267-521-0167. The number is area code 267-521-0167. What are you thinking about tonight? And what are your ideas on what's going on in the field of psychiatry? So, Sue, you were saying, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and also, too, a lot of people are starting to think now, okay, that the book, you know, okay, the psychiatrist's Bible, that it's a sham. A lot of articles, some by psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses from hospitals are reading a lot of articles and videos on YouTube. Okay, they make the videos, the articles, and now they're coming out to say this is a sham, all these disorders, because there's no test at all to prove any of these so-called 500 or what is it, 400 disorders?
Some 500. It's hundreds of pages long, and it's true. Even the two of the directors of the National Institute of Mental Health have now said that this is a hoax. Not a hoax, but not reliable. I'm trying to pull up the article to say the exact words, but that the diagnostic statistical manual is not reliable. That it does not have the testing or the efficacy that is required for people. There was an article, here we go, in the Alliance for Human Research Protection, and this came out some time ago. I think it was May 8th, 2013. Dr. Stephen Hyman, a neuroscientist and former director of NIMH, acknowledged in an article posted on the DANA website that, quote, the underlying science remains immature. The molecular and cellular underpinning of psychiatric disorders remain unknown. There is a broad disillusionment with the animal models used for decades to predict therapeutic efficacy. Psychiatric diagnoses seem arbitrary and lack objective tests, and there are no validated biomarkers with which to judge the success of clinical trials. Furthermore, he acknowledged that there is no real theoretical basis for current drug treatments for mental illness. He noted that existing treatments have not changed since the 1950s and don't work to improve the lives of people who suffer from real mental illness, you know, quote unquote. And he's quoted saying, many patients with mental disorders remain symptomatic and often disabled despite existing treatments. For some significantly disabling conditions, such as the core social defects of autism and the cognitive impairments of schizophrenia, there simply are no effective treatments. And I think that with peer support and self-help, that we have seen that there actually are ways that you can change. In Scientific American, John Horgan, May 4th, 2013, Psychiatry in Crisis, Mental Health Director Rejects Psychiatric, quote, Bible and Replaces with Nothing. And so we need to, like, really start to look at how the leadership of the scientific communities are looking at this and whether or not there is any real benefit to promoting, who is benefiting by promoting what is occurring in psychiatry, because very often it is not the people who are being forced to be involved with it. And so, Sue, your point about genocide is well taken, and I think that, you know, while it's a harsh and serious word, it's one that people should, you know, consider the deeper meaning of, especially this idea of being able to have your children take away, that part of genocide is having your children taken away from one group and given to another group. And that is certainly happening to people with psychiatric histories all over the country, and probably in Canada too, where this issue that you raised concerning the privacy rights of people in Canada and how the government knows, A, that you have some kind of psychiatric history if you've been suicidal, and B, how then the United States government knows this and denies you entrance into the United States, seems to be hugely problematic to me. It just is such a sore spot in this idea of how they could ban Canadians from coming into the U.S. because of a psychiatric history. I really wonder if it goes the other way, too. Do you know by any chance?
No, I don't know at all, Laura, no. About, like, I don't know about, like, Americans, like, when they're at an airport, let's say in L.A., and they want to come to Ottawa, I don't know whether, the people from the USA are stopped at the Canadian border. I have no idea about vice versa, no.
I do think regardless of whether or not it's going both ways, it's still a problem. And for people to really educate yourselves about that and figure out how, I do feel like we should try to test it out somehow and have some kind of statement made about this, because is there anything that, like, for example, Americans could do to write to somebody to express their disdain for this kind of discriminatory action that is taken against people based on the idea of medical records not being private?
Well, I think that a person could, that our prime minister is Stephen Harper, and if people want to look him up, it's Stephen Harper, Harper. And, his title is the Prime Minister of Canada. And I'm sure that he has a website, and then it says contact him. And people could say, Mr. Harper, you know, I hear that a lot of the Canadians who have suicidal on their charts are being, of course, like the denied, you know, entry to the USA. This is not fair. You know, something, like a bit to that effect, because I can't go to the States. I mean, if I go down right now and I take a para because I'm disabled, I go to the international, you know, like Ottawa Airport here. I have my passport. They'll say, Mrs. Wittenberg, come with us. Why? They'll say, we have on your chart that, like I'm going from Ottawa and I'm going straight to New York, okay? On a ticket, straight through, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A charter. They'll take me into a room and say, Mrs. Wittenberg, you are not allowed to enter the U.S. because we know on your file, you know that you try to be suicidal, or like you tried two or three times in your life, twice anyhow. And you need to go back to your family doctor to say, basically, you are okay. So you're denied. So I could have bought my ticket. All my hotel is paid for me and my husband, Stephen, and I'm denied. I have to cancel everything. And the passport now is $80, and the picture, and the hotels, of course. I mean, I want to stay in a, you know, like a safe hotel. It's going to cost money. The food, the tickets, the clothes, you know.
Right,
and this is
well documented in the news, and there's a petition that doctors in Canada have been passing around, trying to get the government to stop doing this. But it really is a questionable practice of how a Canadian can, you know, who's got a psychiatric history, can be denied U.S. entry, really looks at this right of how a fraudulent psychiatric diagnosis. I mean, let's keep this up front.
Mm-hmm.
Something that, or where somebody at some point in their life may have had some kind of emotional crisis,
mm-hmm.
or contemplated, you know, ending their life at some point. How does this kind of treatment in any way, shape, or form increase the desire to want to participate in society? These kinds of things further people away from society and create a distrust in the larger social structures. If you're not even allowed to do what everybody else is allowed to do. And I think that that's one of the big problems that we're seeing with all of these laws, and then internationally, how they're also winding up affecting people. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And tomorrow night, I just also want to mention that we're going to be having a special from 9 to 11 p.m. on electroshock, looking specifically at issues of informed consent and litigation strategies that people can take. Deborah from ectjustice.com will be on, and she will be sharing with us some of her own experiences as a shock survivor and as somebody who successfully was able to settle out of court with a psychiatrist on a psychiatric malpractice suit. And so I think that there are ways that people can make their experiences known, and that you can have potential legal strategies that you might be able to take to sue and to have your rights protected, which is, I think, what most of us are working to try to do. The number to call in is area code 267-521-0167. So I think, Sue, what you were talking about of contacting Harper, and I'm trying to pull up contact information to give out. I think that this idea of being barred from the U.S. Is a very big issue.
I think it's terrible. I mean, it's a form of, the discrimination. It's also a case of, a violation of for my privacy. It's a violation of privacy, and I think it's not okay. I mean, there are 19,000 Canadians' files now are being sent to FBI, the border guards, and to, the police, officials there at the border. And I know that I would be stopped immediately. If I go down to an airport with my passport, I have to get one again. I have to get one because I haven't been traveling for many years. I went to Portugal at 17, but I haven't traveled since. I've gone to the States and up, to Disney World, but at that time, in 84, I didn't need a passport. But now to go into the U.S., you must have a passport. It's no problem me getting a passport. The problem is me to enter right into the USA. I know I'll be barred. I know right away my name will come up. It's right on my mental health file. In 1984, I tried to kill myself. And in 1973, I tried to hang myself here in Ottawa, and then they sent me to the Brockville Psych, the long-term care facility. I spoke of that a few times here on the radio. But the thing is, this makes me upset. Why are they going to pick on me and then the other 19,000 people? I'm not a dangerous person. I mean, I was never put in the hospital. I was never in forensic. I'm not a dangerous person, and I'm not aggressive. But the point is, a lot of us who are not are going to be denied to go into the USA. I just want to go to Hawaii and sit under, I want to go under a palm tree and have a pina colada, and I just want to go surfing, you know, if I can.
Right.
That's
and
all
I
want to do in the U.S.
And so I think it's so important that people that people speak out and let people know about that this is going on and why is this considered acceptable? So the Prime Minister of Canada's webpage contact page is www.pm.gc.ca/ENG/contact PM, it comes right up. It says that the Prime Minister greatly values the thoughts and suggestions of Canadians. You may write or fax his office at Office of the Prime Minister, 80 Wellington Street, Ottawa, Canada, ONK1A082. Or you can fax your letter to area code 613-941-6900. There's also a link on that page where people can just email the Prime Minister to tell him your thoughts about the fact that Canadians are not allowed into the United States government. And I think that that's important. And I think I will take that action myself. And I'm just wondering where we might be able to even start looking for where in the United States who to contact about this. And I will try to figure that out, too, because if it's the United States, the Canadian government may be collecting the information and making it public. But the United States government is who's preventing people from coming in, right? The Canadians aren't saying, oh, you can't go to America. The Americans are saying you can't come here. Is that correct?
Yes, and so what I would say in the States, it might be the national, security or border security or some type of department like that, because I'm not aware of all of your different federal departments. Something to do with national,
Homeland Security?
Yes, something like that, because I think the borders are also a part of that scenario, you know, all the borders, Mexico border, Canadian border. I'm not sure because I'm not too sure of your, the names of your different federal departments. Of course, I know the White House. I mean, I've sent a few letters there. I know the governor of, Sanford had his DCT, I think it was Minnesota.
Right.
Like, I know a few of the departments and the governors, but I don't know. I think it's Homeland Security.
It does look like it's the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. I'm just looking at this article on the Travel Insurance File website, where it's talking again about U.S. border agents accessing Canadian mental health reports. And it would be the Department of Homeland Security. So it says our own investigation into these denied entry cases have shown that without considerable assistance from Canadian police records, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security would have had no evidence for denying either of these women entry. This is something that has been going on, and there's apparently an Ontario Mental Health Police Records Check Coalition, and that website can be found at mentalhealthpolicerecords.ca, and I think that this is a real violation, obviously of privacy, but also of the ability to travel and communicate and work with others and to have the government not letting people in. I think that this is a real issue. So you can do your own research about this and find out information that is in existence there. But there should not be any mental health or psychiatric language that is being used in order to prevent people from coming in or out of countries. And I think that this is definitely a big concern. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167, and let us know what you'd like to talk about.
I want to ask you a question because I'm not sure. I've heard a long time ago, about 4 or 5 years, because I've been like an a psychiatry activist for 30 years, and I read a lot of stuff every day, except, of course, like my, my memory fails me. It's due to electroshock, eh? But I have a question. I heard that in schools there in the USA that they're doing screening of teens for so-called mental disorders. I saw something, I'm sure it was 5 years ago. I mean, I read some of the papers from the States online about teen screening. So if you heard about that,
teen screening
for mental illness or some crazy, something that's not all, it doesn't make sense, eh?
No, yeah. The actual program, I believe, got shut down, I think, in 2012. I'm just trying to get to the information here. I think it was finally proven that it was like a front for the pharmaceutical industries.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something that came out of Columbia University. And so I'm just looking at this Mental Health Weekly news.com article that came out December 10th, 2012, and it says, Teen Screen shuts doors suddenly after 13 years. When Columbia University's Teen Screen program announced last month that it was shutting down effective December 14th, everyone, including the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, was surprised. Overall there was shock that the program, which, according to the website, had contracts with 550 school districts to conduct mental health screenings on middle-age and high schoolers and refer to them treatment if necessary, was suddenly coming to such an end. And so this was shut down. And so it says, for example, since 2006, 2,527 teens had been screened in northern Iowa, and of that group, 460 had screened positive. And so the idea of the screening was really was lacking because it was, well, first of all, it was based on fraud. If you go to psychsearch.net, January 11th, 2007, there's an article that says that the front group for a psychopharmaceutical industrial complex, and that this is very controversial, and it was billing itself as a diagnostic psychiatric service, but was really just funded by the drug companies to support the increase of psychiatric treatment. It says that Teen Screen officials favor passive consent because they say it boosts their chances of screening kids of 95% as opposed to the written parental consent. So there were all issues with consenting. But they're still planning on, with the Barber bill that is highly controversial right now, and in competition with the Murphy bill, the H.R. 3717, one of the things that they're pushing is the idea of screening young people and making sure that you're getting screened. And when we looked at the screening that's available through the Veterans Administration in the United States for veterans, for depression, it's just a 10-question test that generally will have somebody having to go see a psychiatrist regardless of how you answer, but that will have you either calling 911 or being picked up by police if you answer any of the questions in a way that they deem unacceptable, which includes saying that you may, be feeling like you don't deserve to be alive or that life isn't worth living or something like that. And so it doesn't it doesn't really help people any to be doing these kinds of things, and it just is widening the net as to who can be subjected to psychiatry. And I think that, again, this is the big issue, that people are so blindly following the idea that psychiatry has answers when it really just doesn't. If you have an opinion about this or something else you'd like to talk about, you can give a call at area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And I think the toll-free line is area code 855-346-3351. It's area code 855-346-3351. It seems that while people are trying in many different ways, you know, you mentioned that you've been an activist for 30 years, so I think it's so important for people to realize that this is not a new movement, and the peer industry is something that came because of the movement, but that that doesn't necessarily reflect the real values of what the movement was about. And the movement was about protecting our rights and making sure that fraud wasn't perpetuated on the people any longer. And I think to a large degree we've lost in some ways, but that there is still an active movement of people that are working toward trying to educate those in power about these issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to tell you about a story I read. I got to tell you something that's making me sick, okay?
Yes.
I was going to call you. I was going to do an email or talk to you in chat. This is such a sickening story. I was eating last night, and I said to my husband, just put that in the fridge. I can't eat this. Now, this is a cop. He's at home. His wife is pregnant, okay, with their third child, 22 weeks. And he cleans his gun while it's loaded, and it shoots his wife by mistake. Now, I think that story is CRAP crap. What cop, okay, that's in their right mind, would point a gun at his wife, load it, and clean it? So the cops, now I don't know where the story happened. Okay, I have it down somewhere, but anyhow, it's somewhere in the States. And they covered it up and said it was an accident. It was not an accident to what I believe happened, okay? And this happens all the time, that the blue always protect the blue. Now, also, I have a beef about the cops. I think I told you about a week or two on the radio that I had a friend who told me that he wanted to visit me, okay, a peer of mine, okay, that he was not a close friend, but just a peer. He said, I'm lonely. I just want to have a cup of tea and talk. I said, okay. A week later, I didn't have a chance, okay, to invite him because I had the flu. I didn't want my friend to get the flu. He was in his apartment across from the Westgate Shopping Center here in Ottawa, about a half a block away from the Royal, it's Ottawa Hospital. He was in his apartment acting out, and some neighbor heard him screaming, and probably he was swearing, and the whole deal, okay? He was acting out alone. Well, I guess something was upsetting him, and he just flew off the handle alone. So the cops barged into his apartment, the Ottawa police. This is about, I'll tell you when, 1987, 88, okay? He was acting out, and apparently, okay, they said in the paper that they sat on his chest, he asphyxiated, and he died. And, I mean, this man was large, about 6 foot tall, about 200 and some pounds, and he was husky, okay? He was an ace guy, and his father was a lawyer, but he lived alone. And this still upsets me. I didn't have the cup of tea with him, because he was killed by the cops. Now, apparently what happened is nothing happened. Of course, the case went to an investigation, and the cops weren't responsible because he was acting out, and they had to protect themselves. I think he may have said something, okay, like to threaten them. I don't think he physically picked something up to threaten them, from what I believe from the article. It's way back. But he must have said something, okay, to threaten them, and they reacted. I think they overreacted and sat on his chest. Now, I mean, you know, I mean, if you sit on someone's chest, one or two cops, of course he's going to asphyxiate. And then they call the ambulance, and then he died in the hospital. But what I think is very lacking, people do sometimes, okay, like in public or at home, act out. Our police forces are not trained appropriately. They don't have the right equipment, and they're too, like, gung-ho to attack the person right away. Now, I'm very upset that my friend, like a acquaintance, died because the cop sat on his chest. They didn't have to do that, okay? They did not have to sit on his chest and kill this man. It's very hard for me to talk about. I'm very angry. And it's even, like, what, 20 years ago, okay?
I think that this
okay,
is...
Okay, like, the guy was not aggressive. He probably was upset with something that happened in his life and was screaming and yelling by himself. I mean, I do it myself. Sometimes, you know, my husband and I are not physical, but I say, get the heck out of here, Stephen. Today you're on my nerves. Like, just go for a walk. I mean, sometimes, okay, because you know I have the multiplicity, I have, you know, the trauma, and I have the whole works, okay? I don't do this, okay, a lot to my husband, but I do a lot of housing. Okay, sometimes I yell, it's not my fault. I'm not dangerous or anything, but, I told the staff in the office, I mean, if I yell, it's just because I have a lot of bad nerves from my past, and they understand that. I never attacked my husband. I'll say, get the heck out of here, Stephen. You're on my nerves right now. And I don't do it often, but I overreact if he does something wrong or something, okay? But I'm not a wicked person. But my husband knows how to handle me. He says, okay, I'll go and I'll see you later. Goodbye, B-I-T-C-H. I mean, my husband is not perfect. I'm not perfect. But the cops and the neighbors, okay, and the neighbors know that I have, that I'm a traumatized person. I mean, I guess they read it in the papers or I tell them. But the cops don't come in. The neighbors, if I yell, and I don't yell a lot, and I'm not mean to my husband, I'm not mean to him. But we all react sometimes in a different way. I'm not a perfect person, okay, and I'm not a witch. But the thing is, when people do react, and I do react sometimes because I've had horrendous abuse in my past, okay, they know. The neighbors know, and I told them. I told the staff at Ottawa House, if I yell, I am Portuguese, and I have a Latin temper. Like, I'm very quick, okay, because I'm, well, Chris has a Latin background, okay? But I also said because I have trauma. And so the staff know if someone calls that it's okay, in a minute or two, Sue will calm down. But the cops don't come in and sit on me. They don't come and beat me, and they've never been sent here. And I yell sometimes, not a lot. But how come the cops, Lauren, it makes me like, of course I'm overly emotional because I'm emotive, but I'm not upset with you, I'm just upset with the whole system. Why did they sit on my friend's chest, even if he had something in his hand? They could have locked his door, okay, locked the door, and talked to him, like call him on his phone, okay, that they could have locked his front door, okay, because he can't get out, lock it, right, or put out something there. And so they killed my acquaintance. He was 23 years old, a nice-looking young man, very, very gentle, like very polite. He said, Sue, hello. He saw me on the street, okay, because then I was able-bodied. I was walking. He stopped me. He says, hi. How you doing? He said, you're not busy? No, no. So he talked to me. He said, I'd like to come over, to visit you, to have a cup of tea. So not a problem. And I got sick. I had the flu, and I missed seeing my friend for tea because they killed my friend. That's what you're hearing.
I think this is such a tragedy, and I'm so sorry for the loss of your friend.
It still hurts. It hurts. It really. I never talked about this to anybody publicly, or because when I see all these stories in Canada, in the States, and that video I sent you of the Brockville psych of the man. I don't know whether you took a look at it yet. The man Michael that he killed his mother. Like, when I watched that, because I was there, but I wasn't in the forensic ward, just a current ward. When I saw Michael in the Brockville video, and he killed his mother, and the shame, and that, I never hurt nobody in my life, but I felt like him. Like, I have a friend, a queen, who was murdered by the cops. He was a gentle person. He didn't do nothing to nobody. He was just yelling and screaming, I bet, and maybe throwing stuff around by himself. He didn't attack nobody. He was alone in his apartment. And they sat on his chest and they killed my acquaintance. That makes me very sad.
And I think so it is so,
you know,
sad. And the idea
I'm being
of
a bit over. I think I'm.
Well,
too
I just want
to. You know.
I just want to respond to your question a little bit about why are police doing this and why are police not trained?
Yeah.
And it's very upsetting. It's my opinion that that the police or the people are in the wrong role of to be going and doing this. You can't expect a police officer who needs to be on guard all of the time and prepared for all kinds of actual emergency situations and dealing with people who are breaking crimes to be able to all of a sudden switch off and become somebody who is going to be compassionate and supportive and listening and patient. When they need to, in order to be able to protect themselves and us in the course of their jobs, where they need to be on guard and vigilant. You can't expect somebody emotionally to be able to switch back and forth between these two very different roles based on a call that I guarantee you is most of the time it's not even their fault. I'm never even saying that it's the police's fault that these kinds of situations, like with Michael Blair, who was shot 11 times after he hit the floor, or your friend who was asphyxiated, because they're told that they're walking into a quote-unquote dangerous situation. And that is part of the problem. This is part of why we have all of these conflicts with people, and that police are not the people in the right role to be going out on calls for people who are having an extreme emotional state. It just amplifies the problem because they have a tool, and their tool is a gun. When your tool is a gun, and guns in this country are a monstrous problem. There was another shooting today, I don't know if you heard, in Oregon, of another young person killing another person and wounding a staff person, traumatizing hundreds of other children and staff. While they were doing the checks, I thought that this was really disturbing, that while they were checking the students as they were coming out of the out of the school, they found another student who had a gun on them. And it says, during the evacuation of the school, authorities found another student with a gun and he was taken into custody. That weapon and arrest were not related to the shooting. And so this idea of young people having guns when they're being inundated with all kinds of messages about society, I don't even have a clue. If you're a young person listening and you want to give us a clue as to what it's like to be a young person in 2014, because I don't even have a clue. Everything is so drastically different than the freedoms and privacies that we experienced when we were young and the mindset of the country. I mean, just imagine if, you know, we talk about the conditioning of how they, Yvonne says a lot, how they couple violence with mental health, right, and that this is the message that's coming up. What happens if you didn't know it before and you have grown up in this age of where this is all you've known, right? So if you take 2014, 1999 would have been the first big mass shooting, but they point here to a 1998 shooting where Kip Kinkle killed two students and wounded 25 others at a high school near Eugene. So if you look at this, we're looking at 13, 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds who have grown up, every moment of their media experience has included this kind of information.
Mm-hmm.
Every single moment of it. Mm-hmm. And they will never know that freedom of what was before. And then you couple the idea of with that this violence is somehow caused by something that is psychiatric. And you've now alienated an entire population of people, like the 19,000 people who can't get into the United States from Canada because they have a psychiatric record with the police.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are so deeply troublesome. And with the idea of the electronic medical records coming, where nothing mm-hmm. is ever going to be mm-hmm. Private again, or any doctor will be able to see any part of your medical record. Mm-hmm. You know, and I want to say for these people in Oregon who have lost their loved ones, the mm-hmm. deepest condolences. What a tragedy.
Oh, yeah.
We need better yeah. solutions, but their solutions are unfortunately going to wind up leading toward further institutionalization of people and mm-hmm. drugging of people based on a fraud. And I think that's where the anti-psychiatry movement really needs to come in again and say, wait a second,
yes.
this is based on...
Yes.
Yes, this is a problem. Yes, this shouldn't be happening. Yes, this is terrible. I don't think any of us are saying, like, you know, score. You know, these are horrible tragedies of loss of human life. But the answer isn't come after anybody who's ever had a psychiatric history or who in the future might have some kind of psychiatric assignment. It's just not
And I
the
want
answer.
To tell you something else, okay? Of course, I live in Canada. I'm a Canadian. Now, I can't understand why there's so much guns and gangs out there and so many murders. We have murders here, but we certainly have, like, a lower population. But I can't understand why there's so many murders in the States. I mean, and even if I could go to the States to visit, of course, now I can't because it's on my record. I'm suicidal. But I would be scared to go out at night. I mean... Okay, I mean, if I didn't have that on my record about being suicidal and I went to the States, I wouldn't want to walk around at night. But I don't understand this. Well, you have to explain this to me. A lot of Canadians don't understand why there's so much, why there are so many guns, so much murder and violence. Why in the States? In Canada, we have some, but we don't have it on the same scale as the, you know, like on the same scale as your country. I mean, someone has to explain that to me because I can't seem to wrap my head around it. I don't know why there's so many murders in the States every day. All the school shootings. Okay, we have a few in Canada, 3 or 4 and maybe in the last 20. But in the States, what is it, 40 school shootings, like Columbine and all those?
I just heard on the news today that I believe since Virginia Tech, which would have been in maybe 08 or 09, 74 school shootings in the last several years. And we know that in some situations the psychiatric drugs have been associated with them. And we know that, like, SSRIs cause suicidality, and suicide and homicide are related mm-hmm. in terms of anger and where that anger winds up getting directed, either at oneself or at others. So the drugs are a part of it. But I really think that this culture that we are in and that we are existing in is causing us grave damage. If you are listening and have some ideas about what's going on with our society and how to correct it and how it winds up affecting us all, call in at area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. You know, in this article that I'm reading in the Charleston mm-hmm. Daily Mail, they talk about that officer used a robot with a camera to investigate, and that's how they discovered that the suspect was dead and that he had likely killed himself. And so, you know, they're not, mm-hmm. you know, if they use a robot to investigate. I don't know if a robot is the correct response to send in on a psychiatric evaluation, mm-hmm. but they're mm-hmm. coming up with ways where officers can remain safer in the process of when they're going into someplace. But I just think that our technology and the world that we're living in is so far advanced from our own understanding, mm-hmm. like from my understanding of what it was like growing up in the 70s, to yes. what it must be like, you know, growing up now for young people. And
yes.
I'm not the type of person who thinks that, you know, movies or video games or things like that can necessarily make somebody do something. But if television and media didn't have any kind of impact on the actions that people take, why would all of these industries be paying for commercial airtime?
Right. Good point.
Right. Very good point.
I never thought of that.
So you can't on one hand say, like, television and media doesn't affect us, and then on the other know that the reality is that television and media is brought to you by the industry to get you to do things. I think we really need to, like, go back to some of the basics in the early 1900s of psychology and when they were creating and investing in the 1940s. I mean, think about all the, you know, people think about psychologists and they think about, you know, the people who they, you know, therapeutic, clinical kinds of psychologists. What about all of the organizational industrial psychologists, or all of the psychologists who work in marketing, or all of the psychologists who work in war? Like, you need the majority of this. There's this kind of psychology and psychiatry that we're affected by, but there's the larger field of psychiatry isn't about what they call psychopathology. It's about what they call normal psychology, like the, you know, psychology of just human and animal psychology. The kind of psychology we talk about is just a little portion of the field of psychology. This is where anybody who deviates from what's considered normal winds up having to be dealt with through this, you know, this type of psychology. But all the other psychologists are out there trying to figure out how do you dictate, predict, you know, identify, define, predict, and control human and animal behavior. That's what this is about. And so when we look at how these young people are being brought into this world, what their earliest impressions are, what it is they're seeing on the news, how they hear people being talked about, what the news chooses to focus on, right? I mean, every time, you know, there's a some other kind of act of violence, you've got cameras and TV and everything being brought right down to the spot, that they'll break into whatever programming, you know, quote-unquote news that they're giving us to begin with. And so I think that these are part of the problems. I think that this is that we need to change what we're training people to do. In other words, when somebody is suicidal, don't go at them with a gun. Like, that's not the right course of action here. And and secondly, that for all of these young people, I mean, where does a 14-year-old get a gun from? Where? Why does a 14-year-old have a gun? And so, you know, I sounds like sometimes like I talk out of both sides of my mouth, because I personally I would be fine if there were no guns, but if there are guns, I don't want that the fact that I have a psychiatric history to be a predicting reason for me not to be able to have my rights. On the other hand, gun control in terms of young people having guns, why do young people need guns? There can be no legal way that this 14-year-old child got a gun, right? I mean, I don't know. And then, of course, I don't really know enough to be able to talking intellectually about any of this. But if there's I would almost bet that it's not legal in Oregon for a 14-year-old to have a gun. I would probably put money on that. So how is this happening, and what is the predicting reason? And was there some kind of trauma? Was this in response to something else? Was, you know, all of these questions that probably nobody will ever know the answers to, you know, we're left with. And I think that the way police are trained, not in this case of the school shootings, but in the case of how we're treated when they're called for some kind of emotional thing, is very, very important to address. And, you know, and I'm looking at, like, the teen screen stuff that got shut down in 2012. You know, questions like, has there been a time when nothing was fun for you and you just weren't interested in anything? Like, yeah. I don't know. Are these grounds, like, just that nothing's fun and I'm not interested in anything? Like, this, these are what, and so there's no crime here, right? And
yeah.
So the overwhelming majority of things that are involved, that people are involved with when it comes to psychiatric things have no connection to any kind of crime or something that they've done wrong. Nothing is fun,
mm-hmm.
nothing is interesting, feeling like you can't do anything well, or here's the next question. Has there been a time when you felt you couldn't do anything well or that you weren't as good looking or as smart as other people? Boy, if I didn't think that before, you sure as hell
right.
now have introduced that idea into my head. Thanks.
Right.
Like,
right. And, you know, okay, there's one thing that I do, I think, is called a proactive thing I do. When I go into an emergency and I'm in, I'll tell you what happened years ago, okay? A friend committed suicide and I was very traumatized by that. And I lived on a 10th floor and I told a friend of mine, she said, just go down, not the psych hospital, but go to emergency and stay on the ground floor and walk around. So I took a big teddy bear. I got the welfare taxi. I went to the Ottawa Civic and I talked to an intern. I said, listen, yes, I have a psychiatric history, but I'm not dangerous. I'm very upset and I'm on a 10th floor and I have a 10th floor balcony. I said, I don't feel like jumping, but to be safe, I want to talk to you for a bit and walk around the whole hospital tonight and just be quiet. And he said, that's a very good idea. So he talked to me. He touched my shoulder. Said, that's a very good idea. And he said, you're free just to go in the waiting room or walk around. So I had a big, big bear. I was crying as soon as I went to emergency. I said, a friend of mine died, and I was very traumatic, like traumatized. And they didn't say anything. And the guy I saw, the intern, was very compassionate, not judging me about my psychiatric history. I just said, I need a safe place to be right now. You know, like I feel safe on a ground floor. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
And he was very nice. He said, go around. He said, go with your bear and, you know, and have a coffee or tea and keep walking as long as you need to, you know. And then he said, and then you can go home. As soon as you feel safe, go home. So I was very happy to have an intern that was very understanding, told him a bit of my past, but I'm a very traumatized person. My friend, someone told me she killed herself, and I can't handle it. So I'm on a 10th floor, and just to keep myself safe from being on that balcony, it's not a safe balcony on the 10th floor, so I called, I went downstairs, I took the welfare taxi, and I told him. And he was so nice, so compassionate. So I took my big bear, like a big bear a friend gave me from before, and I just carried that around, and I didn't care what people thought about me. I needed to be on a ground floor to feel safe, okay? And then when I go and see a family doctor, I tell him I'm was a former psychiatric patient, now I'm anti-psychiatry, and I said, if ever I say to you that I'm depressed, I don't want no pills. I will not take any of your pills. You know that already. Just talk to me. Just talk to me like, you know, I'm coming in. Let's say my husband died or let's say a friend died. Just talk to me. I don't need the pills. I don't need the hospital. I just need someone to just be a human being with me, to let me talk, eh, to yak, eh? Go ahead. Sorry, Lauren.
No, go ahead,
I had to protect myself, because as soon as they see on my chart, I had a terrible experience, okay? 2 years ago, I fell. I wasn't in, my apartment is for the disabled, because I can't walk anymore, but then I could, I was in a walker at the time, and in a wheelchair. So I went to emergency, and I fell from out of my bathtub and hit my head, and I fell flat on the floor right on my back. I went to emergency because I felt kind of dizzy. And as soon as I went into emergency, and she asked me in front of everybody, I said, I fell and hit my head on the toilet. The first thing she asked me, so are you a schizophrenic? I said, what does this have to do with me falling out of my bathtub and hitting my head on the toilet, waking up? And so I had a concussion. They put me in the MRI machine, you know, that million-dollar machine, and they said, you have very bad concussion. She's mocking me and laughing at me. Waiting for everybody.
It's such a terrible, terrible, terrible.
I said, I hit my head. I may have a concussion. She said, well, how do you know that? So I told the intern, he said, yes, go. He said, okay, he said to me, I had a very bad concussion, to go home and just take it easy. And if I had bad headaches, to come back. But that will, because I guess on my file right away, there's a warning, psychiatric patient, you know, like right on, I'm sure on the file, the first thing they have is diabetic and then psychiatric patient, must be, because, oh, why would she ask me that? I didn't tell her that I had a psychiatric history, so it's right on your chart, psych patient, okay?
Right, and it's
so
right there
humiliated
for everybody to see. And I want to get something that I think this whole is a tragic thing that happens to you. And other callers have called about this, and other people have called, even calling, saying that they need to go to a doctor, but that they're afraid to go to a doctor because that they're afraid that they're going to wind up getting involved with psychiatry because they have an actual physical medical condition. And so this is just horrible. And this again is why, you know, when you were saying that you just wanted somebody to talk to, you don't want any pills, you don't want to be in a hospital.
No.
You just want somebody to talk to you. And doctors, by this very meaning, doctors are in the wrong position of person to be handling this. They are not the right people to be handling this, not to mention all of the pressures that doctors are now under because of the Affordable Care Act in the States, and you're lucky if you get 15 minutes even. They don't have time to talk. They have time to use their tool, and their tool is a prescription pad or a hospital. That's what they've got. Mm. And when you need somebody to really sit with you and talk and share and communicate on a human level, that takes time. And doctors don't have time because they are so overburdened to begin with. The Affordable Care Act in this country is, either way, even if the Affordable Care Act wasn't an issue, they don't have the ability to bring in any kind of money. The young doctors especially are in such debt because the training takes so much money. They don't have time to talk. They don't want to see that your problems are exactly as theirs. And that's the big issue, because they're trained, that it's you know, buried into their understanding that we are fundamentally different than them, and that we are just things that they need to inspect and make decisions about. And so the training of doctors don't have the time or the training to talk. And psychologists and therapists and social workers and people who are trained to talk are being inundated and indoctrinated into the biomedical model with no chance of ever getting to that humanistic model. It's just wiped out. HMOs, managed care companies, are not going to pay for people to sit around talking. They don't see it as something that is medically necessary. And that's a big part of the problem. Line 609, your line is open?
Am I on?
Hi, you're on.
This is Jason from New Jersey.
Hey,
Jason.
I've been listening, I'm just thinking about how psychiatry is really just an arm of the law. That's really the social function, you know, is control. I know that the idea that they're treating real illnesses and everything is what they talk about, but they really do function as an arm of the law, in some preventive way to prevent violence against self or others. And the hospitals are really just prisons, and the treatments are really just tortures. I think about that a lot, and emotional distress is real, and some people have a long history of it, and I do agree with the trauma model, and I think we need to talk in this context, even if we can, about, you know, the alternatives, and how our movement, really all the positive changes that I see, such as groups like Informed Choices and the Hearing Voices Network, and coming off psychiatric drugs, and all the positive changes that have happened really in the past, I guess, 30 years, maybe 50 years, it's all been done by us, you know, people who
right.
resist,
ex-patients,
mm. it's all been us. And I've talked about this with the director where I go at the drop-in center who's been involved in some way with the mental health community. You know, I've talked about that with her, and
what kind of
response? I don't
know.
Well,
just in general. I mean, you don't have to. You know, just
well,
just
what I get. Well, you know, I talk about with her my electroshock experience and all the drugging I've been put through over the past, you know, 20 years since I was 18 and how I got into the system. I told her my story. And I tell other people who I come in contact with who are in the system and being forced to take drugs so they can have housing and food and
such a scam.
And what I get is, you know, well, I still get the same stuff. I still get the psychiatry, you know, they're working on it. We've got, you know, they're working on new tools. We've got brain scans now and we're going to figure it out eventually, and eventually we're going to figure out, you know, the genetic component of schizophrenia and bipolar, but it's not going to happen, okay? It's not going to happen.
Right. They've been saying this centuries.
And if they do figure it out, then we'll be seeing neurologists, and we'll have real medicine will be involved. It's
real medicine that you'll probably have a choice as to whether or not you can take. I mean, like any other medical field. Oh, you know, you need to take this for your cholesterol. Oh, well, I've looked at that, and that's got lots of side effects. I'm not going to take that. Okay, well,
right.
Then maybe you want to change your diet. You know what I mean? Like, this is...
Right.
Profession, the idea that that what they have to offer, that people can't, quote-unquote, see what it is that they need, and they have no insight...
Mm-hmm.
As grounds for being able to grow their profession is
right.
It's such a crime, and I thank you for bringing up these alternatives. And I was going to talk a little bit about some of this tonight because of the Mind Freedom Conference that's going to be in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
July 24th to the 27th, and these are the things that they're talking about. You know, peer-run respites, creating places to withdraw from psychiatric drugs, hearing voices network. And, you know, I found a little blurb on their website, on Mind Freedom website, about soteria houses. And,
you know,
Lauren Mosier, the psychiatrist who really
mm-hmm.
started putting this forth, was sorely missed. And what a great contribution he left
mm-hmm.
for us to work with.
And he showed she proved scientifically that his methods worked, you know, and that they really genuinely helped people reintegrate into the community, get jobs, have relationships. His whole system worked, and they shut it down, right?
Right, and
I mean,
there are a couple, and so the Soteria House model, there's one in Alaska, there's a couple that are popping up. But it says on the Mind Freedom website, soteria houses are homes, like residences, which are designed to help persons who are experiencing their first episode of symptoms which led them to be diagnosed with psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
In the soteria house, such persons are safe both physically and psychologically. There is no pressure on them to get better, to get back on track, or to stop having those thoughts or hallucinations. Rather, they are told that they can stay until they feel more stable, and the staff will be with them and help them go through the experiences they are having. The treatment is based on the relationship, and goal is to help the person go through the experience in a safe place where they are understood and affirmed and can slowly learn
mm-hmm.
whatever can be learned from the experience. And I think that, you know, when you look at, like, R.D. Lang's work, psychiatrist
mm-hmm.
who is completely, like, you know, written off as, you know, illegitimate. One of the things that he talked about
mm-hmm.
in a chapter called The 10-Day Journey was that when somebody can come through what is called psychosis and come out the other end, that there is so much insight and learning that has been created and such a
yeah.
new understanding of the world.
Yeah.
And so one of the things Lauren Mosher really sought and pushed after was that people need to be affirmed, and that this is something that they can come through and that will make them better. And when you go into a traditional psychiatric kind of place, these places tell you that you're less than human and you need to be controlled and that you're sick and that this is bad. And so if we're telling people that what they have, that the thing that is most real to them is the thing that is sick and needs to be cut out,
how
that breaks the human spirit, how it just destroys
mm-hmm.
people. And that there are these things, and like also at the Mind Freedom Conference, they're going to be having discussions around peer-run respites, which are set up to provide a warm, comforting, home-like environment staffed by people who themselves who have been through their own crises. It's non-hierarchical and non-pathologizing, and these
mm-hmm.
homes offer short stays and focus on crisis resolution. I'm reading from Mind Freedom's website, and I think it's important for people to realize that when somebody is in a crisis, an institution is not necessarily the only place that one can go, and it's certainly not the best place that you can help somebody get back on, you know, onto what it is they want, of where they feel like they can live with it. And without these alternatives, without mutual assistance and self-help kinds of settings and environments,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would be where I am right now.
Right.
don't know. I finally got out of the psychiatric system, but if I was going to the psychiatric system with what it is I go to people who I consider like-minded
right.
people and my support system, I'm sure I would be getting locked up every other week.
I
you
know
what I mean? I would be on a revolving door. You
sure.
know, just the idea of, you know, saying that I wanted more for my life or that I rejected, you know, what it was that psychiatry had to offer is grounds for getting locked up, right? So
mm-hmm.
we
mm-hmm.
need these alternatives, and we need people to, you know, start speaking about them as in the psychiatric world, in the media, to start telling the average person, hey, these things exist. What if the media was doing a weekly spotlight on a different support kind of place that
yeah.
was
yeah.
run by people who have lived experiences? How many people would be getting a different message of, hey, there's someplace else I can go? Who doesn't want to? So I think that, Jason, what you bring up is really important. And the other night you mentioned preventative detention.
Yeah, preventative detention.
Could you just talk about that a little bit again? Because I think
I don't know about it legally, but that's really what they're doing when they're saying, you know, they're like chart. I mean, they kind of. You know, a lot of cases, if you're deemed violent or suicidal, I mean, you know, you're held for the 72 hours without, you know, without being charged. I mean, that's preventive detention, and that's actually illegal. I mean, it's a violation of your constitutional rights. But, you know, if you have a psychiatric history or
right.
if you're labeled, you know, it's like these, I live in fear now. And now that I've been electroshocked and I don't have my memory, and when I go to health professionals, I've been to neurologists and other people and even my family doctor, I'm not believed that I have these severe amnesia and these other issues. I'm really not taken seriously, and I haven't been, and I'm concerned about that because the medical community is indoctrinated just like, you know, into the psychiatric beliefs.
So you tell them that you don't have, that you've lost some cognitive
yeah,
functioning with memory,
yeah,
and,
right,
and they tell you you're lying?
They don't take it seriously. I've been told by neurologists that, you know, it's not that bad. You know, basically I'm treated as if I'm just exaggerating, and somewhat so also by my family. They do believe me, because, you know, I don't know if I can survive like this without peer support. I'm still really trapped in the system. I'm still, you know, I do see a therapist who's helping me, who understands the system and what it is. But even he doesn't have, as a psychologist, he doesn't have any sway. You know, he can't prevent me from, being pushed back into the hospital.
Right, because there's a hierarchy there, and he's
not
a doctor.
They have, it's like psychiatrists are like above. I mean, they're not. They are
above
the law. They're above the law, and it's frightening.
Yeah.
And if you have a label, you live in a police state, and that's what I feel like. I feel threatened. I mean, it's not like it's just amazing what they can, you know, put the situation that, because of the power structure, the situation that they can put people in life, and it's just amazing the power they have, and that I'm glad we're going to do this show about the upcoming electroshock and the legal legal aspects of this with the consent, and also I would feel a whole lot better if I could have taken my psychiatrist to court. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get help. And again, the psychiatrists have so much power that it's difficult to do anything legally. But they disempower, they maim people, and it's true. What we said, the show started out. You Sue mentioned, you know, genocide, and it's true. I mean, the numbers of people that they're maiming and deceiving is amazing. It's
electroshock.
So
100,000 people a year in the States. A million to 2 million worldwide. The overwhelming majority, more than 70% of them women. Women who are over 62 years of age. The fraud that is perpetrated by this absolute intentional brain damage, coursing 100 to 190 volts of electricity through somebody's brain to cause a grand mal seizure, which epilepsy foundations and others work to try to find cures from. It's preposterous, and it's absolutely bloodless.
I don't understand how they can still do it. I don't understand why it's been going on for, you know, now it's going on, you know, to be like 80 years. They've been using just the electricity to shock people.
1938.
Before that, they had chemicals, different chemicals.
And the insulin and metrazole.
That's been outlawed. And it's really actually more dangerous now than it was when before they had anesthesia, and because of all the all the drugs people were on before I was on, you know, several drugs before they have to, because of the anesthesia and the muscle paralyzer, they've got to up the electricity. These machines are not safer now than, and that's what I was told during, you know, for the consent, that this was a mild amount of electricity being used, and for such a brief, you know, for a tenth of a second. But, you know, this is wall current, and your brain operates in millivolts. It's a massive, you know, blow to your nervous system and brain.
It's just criminal. This is a crime against humanity. Like Don Whites and others have said over and over again, this is not treatment. This is torture. This is not something medical. And, you know, Jason and Sue and others who are listening, I want to give out the number 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you're listening online and want to talk, just make sure that you press the one button. But this is such a crime, and the average person who is going to a psychiatrist does not know any of this.
They don't know.
They don't
know
anybody.
I know, and virtually now everyone is you know, potential psychiatric prisoner or slave. Anyone, you know, it can happen in any from you know, cradle to grave. We're potential. Victims or of the system,
right? And literally cradle to grave for like young people who are winding up in the foster care system, or whose parents who they're taken away from their parents simply because their parent has a psychiatric history, and then funneled into the foster care system where they're being drugged and their traumas are being ignored and they're not being given any kinds of support, and how many of them are being experimented on when the state is your parent and worked around and made money off of as there are people still, despite all of this, with such resilience, who have come through and made great changes in this world and had successful lives despite every obstacle that was put in front of their way by the state, but that this is cradle to grave. They are going after 0 to 2 year olds. It is legal to give a 3 year old Haldol, one of the heaviest atypical antipsychotic drugs in existence. The damage that we're doing to children, the attention deficit disorder fraud, the children, and this goes back again to what's it like growing up in 2014? These teenagers, what have they been exposed to for the last 10 to 15 years on television? War and violence and totally twisted versions of what humanity really is, what femininity is, what masculinity is, these designed traps that people are falling into, and when they get caught and they wind up in psychiatry's clutches, it is just, and you use the word meme, and Andrew Scull used in Madhouses, where he talks about Henry Cotton, the psychiatrist who said that the issue was focal sepsis, that they maimed and murdered are the words that he used, and that this is continuing. They keep on changing the part of the body that they're going after, or organ that they're going after.
I've read that. I read that book about focal sepsis in Trenton State Hospital here in New Jersey. Just removing one organ after another, and teeth, and based on his theory of focal sepsis,
which is very close, quite frankly, to, and it's an infection. Yeah, it's a monster infection, and it's very close to Toxoplasma Gandhi theory of Tori and Yogin. That
is
from cat feces.
The cat feces thing?
Right.
I mean, it's just harebrained stuff. And, you know, they latched it. Psychiatry's always latched on to whatever, you know, whatever new technology, magnets, electricity, chemicals. They just latch on to whatever is in vogue, and they try to adopt it with the smart pill and deep brain stimulation. You know, we've talked about lobotomies here, stereotactic surgery. They freeze parts of the brain. They use lasers.
Wait, freezing parts of the brain? What's that? What kind of surgery?
I don't know. You know, neurosurgery, where they psychiatric. You know, what they used to call lobotomy. You guys were talking about this the other night, and leucotomy, lobotomy, cingulotomy. All the other versions. But, you know, they do still do it, and they call it something else. Like you were saying, they call it stereotactic surgery. They they still damage brain tissue. They just do it. They can do it more precisely with lasers. With I think they actually freeze, you know, kill brain tissue by freezing it. They just have more, you know, more sophisticated ways of destroying and invading people's brains based on false theories. They always
right. I just want to call back to what you just were talking about the smart pills, which are real. This is no longer like a science fiction or the fantasy of a madman. This is, a supposed madman scientist, I guess, that these are real and that people are being subjected to them, and that if you're a veteran, there was an article that was published by NPR on how the military plans to test brain implants to fight mental disorders, mm-hmm. and that is being mm-hmm. funded through DARPA, and that their goal is to implant small electronic devices into the brain to rewire brain circuitry. And the people that they're looking at doing this on are veterans who have a history of post-traumatic stress or some kind of, quote-unquote psychiatric thing. And so, again, if you're a veteran and you ever want to call in and talk about what's happening to you or to others or things that you see in the VA that are a concern to you, please do so, because I think it's important that this gets exposed. But the technology is just outrageous. And the way that they mm-hmm. sell it with that, it's a prettier machine now. It looks like it's the electroshock device, right? It looks like it's all kinds of complicated. You take it apart, mm-hmm. it's one wire. You know, it's just an electrical wire. Whatever buttons mm-hmm. and bells that they've put on it to make it look
right.
like it's a, new improved thing, it is still a current of electricity that is being shot through somebody's brain to mm-hmm. create brain damage. And mm-hmm. So it's more pervasive. It's prettier. It's getting better publicity. You know, when
right.
this stuff, in the 1900s, for example, Freud, right, he was thought of as like a dirty old man and not taken with any seriousness whatsoever. And, and Freud, for the, quote-unquote, one of the fathers with Charcot and Breuer of psychology and psychiatry, mm-hmm. he what his whole thing was, because this is after the 1890s, where it went into a total medical component, because the asylum system was based mm-hmm. on people healing and talking and being treated well, because we had been tied to, basement walls and dungeons and given bales of hay to sleep on
mm-hmm.
naked, right? And so when that was exposed, then it goes into like this, no, we need to talk to people. People can heal. Maybe a little too much religiosity in terms of moral and what
right.
is moral.
Mm-hmm.
But still not the medical model. And then in the 1860s, it swung back to the medical model. And then in the 1890s, it was discovered, and they tried to, normalize the idea of it as a state hospital. And
right.
then Freud comes, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and Freud says that it's a talking cure and that he wants to be giving everybody cocaine. Right, that's
right.
That's what Freud. People should be able to talk. They should be talking about sex. They shouldn't be sexually repressed. That sexual repression is like a lot of what's going on here. And people should have cocaine and they'll feel better. Like that was Freud, right? So Freud would be rolling in his grave with what's happening. Not that I hail him in any kind of way, ordinarily. But if you take it from that kind of perspective of what he was saying really needed to happen for us. And then you look at, and at the same time, around then, Henry Cotton is starting in, 1908 or so, and Adolf Meyer is in charge, and, the most unethical person in the world that the American Psychiatric Association still gives awards in his name. He knew what Cotton was doing. He was doing
yeah,
the
yeah.
research into it, and Phyllis Greenacre, who eventually became the president of the American Psychoanalytic Society or whatever in New York, she moved from there, but all going on at John Phipps with Watson, while Watson is trying to condition fear into a baby. And so they start cutting out our body parts, and Meyer knew it, and Cotton did it, and then they started doing it everywhere. And there's an exhibit at the Psychiatric Lore Museum, which I will be going to on July 3rd. I'm so excited about this. I try to go every year. And there's an exhibit that actually has one of the colonic tables that was used and that all these state hospitals wound up doing mandated colonics to people prior to taking out, you know, taking out all of their teeth and then starting to slowly cut out each of their organs. And, oh, and if you were a woman, your ovaries, your
uterus,
colon, people having to have colostomy, like really, 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 you know, in the name of a quote unquote cure. And
he just got right. Yeah. He killed so many people during that. It was like, I guess it went on for about 20 years.
Yeah. Killed hundreds and maimed thousands.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, Phyllis Greenacre, as a psychologist, I really had a deep Andrew Scull. I go read Madhouses, but she actually wrote at one point that she knew that if she spoke out, it would be professional suicide, and how she regretted that all of these years, and how she knew that if it wasn't for the fact that she was protected by her education, that would be where she was. And Meyer at one point actually did diagnose her psychotic, and as he did Clifford Beers. I mean, think about it. In 1908, this is when Clifford Beers was putting forward the Committee on National Committee on Mental Hygiene, which he attributes Meyer being the one who named it. And that wound up supporting eugenics and wound up working closely with the 33rd degree Rite, Scottish Rite Masons. And that the Scottish Rite Masons have been funding schizophrenia research, to the best of my knowledge, at least since the 1930s. Some of that money went to Dr. Loretta Bender, who in the 40s, in the 40s was doing electroshock on children, including insulin and metrazole shock. And then in the 60s, that was at Bellevue, and then in the 60s, Bender was doing LSD research on children locked up at Creedmoor in Queens, New York. And that it all flips back and forth, and each time the psychiatry gets busted for what it is they're doing, they come back stronger and harsher and looking prettier and better. And Thomas Saz is, one of my favorite lines from Thomas Saz is that slavery cannot be reformed, it can only be abolished, and that this is just prettifying plantations. And and I think that it is so urgently, right, you know?
No, when that's what, after I was electroshocked and I found, you know, I started reading Thomas Saz, I just, you know, he doesn't mince words. I mean, there's no,
And, you know, and quite frankly, I mean, I think one of the places where I part with Saz is that he doesn't really take into account the trauma issues, but, you know, this is 50, 60 years
that's
ago.
True, I agree.
And there's a lot of, but I do think that personal responsibility is part of it. And I do think that more than personal responsibility, it's the way that, and what I think Saz really missed, is that it's not that people don't have personal responsibility, it's that their idea of themselves as a person has been stolen from them. And so it becomes where you are less than, and need to be directed and need to be told what to do, and because your faith in yourself is
that's
stolen
true. And
from
that can happen. That can happen from very early on. You know, that can happen when you're before you're, I don't know, five or something.
Right.
Well,
absolutely.
You can grow up with that.
And if it hasn't entirely happened by the time you get to the psychiatric industry, puts the nail in it, and that it's by design, and that's their goal, and that if it's not just the what it is they can do to you in terms of the electroshock and the restraint and the drugs and institutions and all of that, but it's also the fact that those things wind up, like people tell me often, and I think it was I can't really remember in my own experience, but that the drugs made it easy for them, because they were on these drugs, it made it easy to believe what it was they were being told, because they were being drugged.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think with the newer drugs.
That just reminded me of like you and Cameron and the there in Canada, at the Allen Memorial and all that stuff that went on, all the brainwashing and all the experimentation that went on. It was paid for by the they were paid by the CIA.
Right, MK Ultra funding, right?
MK Ultra, yeah, and there were other.
The electroshock in the sleep rooms that they described him having.
Right.
I don't know if people don't know who Cameron was. Jason, do you want to talk a little bit about that, or?
I don't know. You can talk about it. I've read about it and watched a lot of video and film about it, but, and I've heard some of the survivors talk about their experiences in this ward with eminent, world-renowned psychiatrist, Ewan Cameron. I don't remember I haven't looked at that in a while, but I don't know how many people were involved, but I've heard, I've seen, he literally just destroyed people and emptied them out. I mean, he called it psychic driving. And
right.
He
yeah.
used drugs and recordings that they would, they would shock and I don't know what, I can't remember too much about
it. Yeah, no, but the psychic driving, I was trying to remember the name of it myself because it's been some time since I've looked at it myself, but I do remember that it was with things called sleep rooms of where people would be just drugged out for weeks, put into comas
yeah.
of sorts, and the electroshock, and that he was like this really prominent, important person
oh, yeah.
that everybody respected
yeah.
deeply, right? Like that,
mm-hmm.
and this is where it gets all twisted. Sue from Canada, do you have any?
Happened? Okay, that a victim of his is called Linda McDonald. And, that she saw Dr. Cameron for some type of, she was depressed. She
yeah,
came
she was,
out
like,
of
wildly
there,
depressed
and she didn't even know her own kids that came to visit her.
Yeah.
She lost all the memories of all the births of her kids. And then about 20 years ago, they had a big lawsuit. I think they got $100,000 each, I think. But Linda was totally destroyed by this psychic driving because she has no memories of her childhood. She doesn't have the memories of her marriage or the memories of all her, she doesn't even recall the birth of her kids, Linda McDonald. If you Google it, it's quite the story, a horrifying story. And then he used to put these helmets on their heads, like a helmet,
yeah.
like a motorcycle helmet, and he'd say, you were this, you were that, psychic driving.
Yeah.
And then he put something, something that was underneath their pillow, so they heard this all night, the same psychic driving.
Yeah, and
a lot
just,
of people were damaged,
Yeah, absolutely, and just so that people know, if you Google psychic driving, one of the first listings that comes up for it is a peer-reviewed article by Cameron, published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, in 1956, volume 112, pages 502 to 509, the American Journal of Psychiatry, gives you everything that his theory was, and I'll be talking about this more, and Jason, I thank you for bringing it up, because I think it's important that people realize this is like in the 50s when they're aiming commercials for electroshock to husbands to reprogram their women and to correct them to being compliant in their ideas. And probably not too long before Jackie Kennedy was electroshocked in Massachusetts because she was sick of her husband.
And Bonnie Burstow has written some great papers about women and electroshock and how it's used to control women, really.
Yeah.
And
I'm excited to announce that Dr. Bonnie Burstow will be on, I believe, June 24th, talking the entire show about her work, yes. We're still in the final stages of setting it up. But June 24th, I believe, and we're going to continue these specials on electroshock, and continue to get the word out about that. And I think, you know, we'll continue to find people who have kinds of information like this, that you might know some hidden story of psychiatry or psychology that gives us some light as to why things are happening the way they're happening now, and where this barbaric kind of treatment was allowed, who were the first people who funded these kinds of things, who said, hopefully maybe someday Leonard Roy Frank will come on and talk about his work.
Well,
yeah.
Electroshock.
I'll tell you what happened about Leonard. That I got a call from him, a week ago, that we had a program, and he called me. He said, "Sue, I haven't talked to you in a long time." And he just, talked to me. I know Leonard. But the thing is, I wish that I asked him, I said, "I'd like you to be a guest on the show." And he said, "I'm going to let all the others do that." He's very, not shy.
Hi, Leonard, if you're listening, hi. And I'm going to reach out again because I think that...
Yeah, Leonard, for sure.
Leonard Roy Frank's work is just something that should be standard reading. It should be standard reading for any student.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly in psychology classes that I teach, I talk about Leonard Roy Frank's work and expose them to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that I think that there are so many people that are really doing such phenomenal stuff out there in terms of alternatives, in terms of legislation, in terms of reaching out, advocacy, activism, organizing. If you're out there listening and you're doing something that you want people to know about, call in and talk about it. That's what this is about. This is, I mean, while I can go on a rant for hours on end, and I do enjoy doing it, this is about people, I do, this is about people having an independent stream to the media that we hope will be able to reach people. And people are listening, and so I also want to thank people who are taking the time to listen to the show and when you're ready to call in and talk about it. Because I think that when more of us talk, we grow stronger. And we develop more of a base to work from. And I think it also creates alternative support networks that people might not have known about or had before, and ways to connect people up. And, I'm in the process of learning about how people become affiliates of, like, Mind Freedom locally where they are. And I'm trying to learn what that process is so I can better explain it to people, because it isn't everywhere. But there's no reason why, if you agree with the values that are being put forth by organizations like Mind Freedom, that you don't take a leadership role. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about this movement, is that it's our own original experiences that qualify us as experts, nothing else.
Just
the simple fact that we know this system from a firsthand experience. Mm-hmm. And that anybody who's had this experience can speak up about it, and that you don't need to hang around for 10 years before you can talk. You can talk the day you find out about it. And I think that makes it a very special and rare kind of thing that people can find if they learn about it. And so trying to do this show is one way of trying to let people know about all of the work that's being done all over the world.
Well, I just want to mention, too, that you can download, I think it's free, Leonard Frank's Electroshock Quotationary. He has other books of quotations, but there's one that I think you can get free online.
Yes.
I think I have
it's
a printout somewhere.
It's at theendofshock.com.
Okay.
I'll tell you where it is. Endofshock.com.
Okay.
The website.
That's right.
Endofshock.com.
And
he wrote the history of shock treatment. I believe it was in the late 70s.
I actually have a copy, and
it's wonderful.
I do, too. I have a copy of that as well.
Yeah, that book with the red cover, yeah.
I think it's important. Endofshock.com is also the website that John Breeding pointed to last week on the electroshock special as a good resource for people. And to be aware that this is happening to people all over the world. It is happening to young people, children, adults by court order, and senior citizens, people, elderly people, that we need to be speaking out and educating. If you want to check out the website that's going to be getting discussed in depth tomorrow night, the ectjustice.com, Deborah will be on tomorrow from 9 to 11 talking about these issues and potential litigation.
It's going
to be a good show. Oh, yes. I'm really looking for. I'm imagining I'm going to learn quite a bit. So if you want to check out that website prior to the show, and if you have this specific questions that you'd like to see if Deborah can answer, the website for that would be ectjustice.com. I'm really hoping that over the next period of time that we're going to be able to start to influence people. Continue to reach out to your legislators. Call them, introduce yourself, tell them what, ask to speak to an aide, tell them what your interests are and what your concerns are, tell them how you want them to be voting on different legislation that you want them, if there's ever any kind of legislation that is opposing human rights or that is promoting any kind of forced psychiatric interventions or involvement, that you want them to vote no on those things and that you don't want them to sponsor things. And if your legislators are sponsoring or co-sponsoring bills that you think are oppressive or cause problems for people, tell them about it. You have a vote. You have a power there in your vote. Mm-hmm. And then if there are other people in your area who feel the same way you do or friends and family members who are willing to support you, you tell that legislator that you are not alone and that there are people that support this who also vote for him and who want to see him vote against these kinds of, or her, want to see him or her vote against these kinds of measures. And I think it is urgently important that we all speak up in these ways and speak out. We talked earlier about contacting Prime Minister Cameron, Prime Minister, help
Harper.
Me. Harper. Thank you.
Stephen Harper.
Yes, Prime Minister mm-hmm. Cameron. Sorry, I'm looking at the Cameron's electroshock page and it came up. Prime Minister Harper about the release of Canadians' mental health records, preventing them from getting into the United States. I will be looking further into this as to whether or not it goes both ways and whether or not as United States citizens, whether or not we're allowed to cross into Canada. And any potential issues of that. The June 24th, I believe it is, Dr. Bonnie Burstow will be on talking about her work and her phenomenal work. And I will be giving information to people before that so they can check it out if they're not familiar with it, so that when she calls in, if you have specific questions or that you'd like to do. Yes.
I just want to mention that Bonnie's going to have a book launch in Toronto on September 12th.
Oh.
And the book is called Psychiatry, I think it's Disrupted. Okay, and it's also with Chandel Diamond and with Brenda LaFrançois. I hope I can go. I have two broken shoulders. I'm in a wheelchair, but I hope that Steve and I can go for a day or two down to Toronto, because I really like to see that. But I'm in a wheelchair. I can't walk anymore. But I hope I can get down by plane, because train would be too difficult now with my back problems. But I like to go, so I'm going to try.
Do you know the name of the book?
Yes, it's called Psychiatry. It's called, Disrupted. Psychiatry Disrupted. And the book launches in Toronto at OISE, O-I-S-E. It's per the Toronto, it's per of U of T, and it's on September 12th.
That's the University of Toronto, right?
Pardon me?
Yeah, and that promises to be a fundamental reading book for everybody. The people who are involved in that are really dedicated and
who
brilliant.
Can you say more about the two other people that she mentioned, along with Bonnie Burstow, co-authoring, I guess, that book?
Yeah. Yeah, and then
Shondell Diamond. Shondell, Shaindl Diamond. And
okay.
Brenda LaFrancois.
Okay.
And Brenda had been on. Brenda had been on last week on the first electroshock show and has done a phenomenal work around electroshock on children also.
Okay.
I know, like I'll tell you about Shondell, she was a student of Bonnie's there at the U of T. I believe now she's her PhD or master's or whatever, but she just had a baby, Shondell.
A PhD, I believe, and her work is phenomenal.
Yeah.
We have 10 seconds left.
Okay.
If you have
thank
a
you.
Tip, thank you, Jason, thank you for everybody who listened. Mm-hmm. And if you have a tip, call in 718-273-8708.
See you tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm. Hello? Good night.